Good morning, this is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. Today, for the first time, Pope Benedict has spoken publicly on the predator-priest sex abuse scandal embroiling the Catholic Church. The Pope says he plans to do more to protect children, and no let-up in the calls for a royal commission into the circumstances surrounding the death of gangland identity Carl Williams. But first this morning, the former Victorian Premier Geoff Kennett has delivered a scathing assessment of the Prime Minister's health reforms, advising people to get fit because he thinks they won't be able to rely on the future health system. Mr Kennett, who now heads the mental health organisation Beyond Blue, does support the introduction of case mix funding and local health networks, two reforms he pushed through when he was in state politics. He's urging Western Australia's Premier Colin Barnett to stick to his guns and not sign away control of part of his state's GST to the Commonwealth. Mr Kennett is speaking here with Chief Political Correspondent Lyndall Curtis.
I don't want to be political, and I'm not political. I make these comments as a lay person, but who's had experience in introducing reform, not only into health, but into many other areas of public policy. And I've got to say, I can't see anything good out of the way in which this package has been developed or delivered or in part secured. And I think quite the contrary, it is going to put the health of many Australians probably from about 3 to 4 years' time, very much at risk.
Why do you think it's so bad?
Sadly, the Prime Minister has had a rush to the head that he wants to be seen and remembered for the man who introduced reform into the health area of public policy. He hasn't sat down with his people and developed a complete package. In other words, he's had this rush to the head. I'm going to reform health policy. I'm going to take over 60% of the cost of operating hospitals, but we've witnessed in the last few weeks, after that original policy announcement rushed to the head, every 2 days there's been another policy announcement throwing money at the premiers to buy their vote. If the original concept for reform is not properly developed and thought through, that you have to bribe people to get their support, there's something wrong with the original model. This is supposedly the biggest reform in public policy in Australia. We don't have clear definition as to the policy. We don't know about the people who are going to drive it, and yet you're prepared to risk everything that currently exists today.
The former Victorian Premier Geoff Kennett speaking to Lyndall Curtis. Last night, former Prime Ministers and foes Bob Hawke and John Howard shared a stage and had the debate they never got around to in 1987. Oddly enough, the Silver Bodgie and the Man of Steel agreed on a lot of things. Both men still say they're passionately in favour of immigration and economic reform. There was plenty of back-scratching and jokes, but neither man had much to say about Kevin Rudd's federal health reforms. Simon Santo went along to the dinner in Sydney for AM.
On their way into the dinner hosted by the Oxford Business alumni, and even before a drink was poured, the mood was very positive.
No points to score, just enjoying life and thinking what a great country it is.
And from Bob Hawke, respect for his former political opponent.
I thought he was easily the most substantial of the ones I faced.
In 1987, it wasn't so pleasant. The two men had faced off in a federal election campaign, but Mr Hawke refused to debate Mr Howard.
My first question, I guess, is to Bob Hawke. Why was it that you ducked him in 1987?
I think John was so taken up with having to sort out a bloke called Joe Jogi Peterson.
The former Prime Ministers might be retired now, but they're still keenly interested in today's political issues, such as hospital reform.
Many of the things that have come out of this deal are good. I'm frankly quite confused about what the administrative arrangements are. I find it hard to believe that out of this new arrangement we're going to have fewer bureaucrats.
Asked whether a federal takeover would deliver a better health system, Bob Hawke was a long way from praising his Labor colleague, Kevin Rudd.
I genuinely think it's too early to answer your question.
In foreign policy, the invasion of Iraq and the absence of weapons of mass destruction remain a sore point.
In the intelligence world, you never wait for pluperfect proof, otherwise you end up with another Pearl Harbor.
The Iraq invasion has increased the strength of terrorism forces around the world.
Both men continue to disagree on a republic, but they're united on wanting to do away with the states, although they agree it will never happen.
We'll still have states in 20 years. I think they'll be politically less significant than they are now.
Get rid of the states, keep the boundaries for the purposes of Sheffield Shield cricket and state of origin.
State of origin.
Sport and cricket in particular was safe ground, as Bob Hawke congratulated John Howard on his impending appointment to the International Cricket Council before showing off a friendship that clearly survives the political divide.
While he would be one of the world's worst cricketers. Supposed to be a spin bowler, not bullshit. I've met no one who has a more genuine love for cricket than John. And
you know, I know my cricketing skills were modest, although I was always able to keep my glasses out of the way of the ball.
After almost 2 hours of conversation, the former foes gave each other a hug and left the stage.
Simon Santo reporting. To today's federal politics, and after all the allegations of rorting and dodgy workmanship, it's understood that the federal cabinet has decided to axe the rest of its controversial home insulation scheme. The program was stopped in February due to safety concerns and claims of rorting, and at the time the Prime Minister promised a revised scheme would start in June. The government's declined to comment on media reports this morning. The opposition says there needs to be a full judicial inquiry into the insulation scheme. From Canberra, Sabra Lane reports.
The deaths of four workers linked to the insulation scheme, scores of house fires and claims of widespread fraud have plagued the government. In February, the Prime Minister paused the $2.4 billion program and commissioned respected former bureaucrat Dr. Alan Hawke to review it and recommend changes for a revamped scheme, which Mr. Rudd promised would start on June the 1st. Fairfax papers claim that Dr. Hawke's report is highly critical about the policy's development and implementation and that timelines for starting the revised program in June were insufficient. It's reported that Cabinet ditched the scheme yesterday to focus on fixing the 50,000 homes that have had foil insulation installed and concentrate on safety inspections for another 150,000 other homes. The minister responsible for the program, Greg Combe, has declined to comment. The finance minister, Lindsay Tanner, was asked about it on Radio National.
I'm afraid that I can't comment on Cabinet deliberations, but we are focused very intently on dealing with the problems that have emerged in the home insulation program, of dealing with the checking of people who are at risk and making sure that we fix those problems. That's our key priority in this area. That's what we're going to continue to focus on.
The opposition's environment spokesman is Greg Hunt.
The government's been split for some time. Greg Combe has wanted to drop the program. The Prime Minister, for reasons of pride, has wanted to keep the Pink Bats program going. We know that it's been a disaster. We think that Combe has stared the Prime Minister down with the evidence that this program is simply unsalvageable. Right now, we want a commitment that every one of the million homes will be inspected so as we can find and fix 240,000 dangerous and dodgy roofs.
He says the government must release the Hawke report, and Mr. Hunt says there should be a judicial inquiry.
The Prime Minister must release the information from the Hawke report and launch a judicial inquiry. No more cover-ups. There has been delay and denial now for well over a year.
There's an Auditor-General's inquiry. That's not enough.
The Auditor-General's inquiry has excluded, at the government's request, an inspection into how the four deaths were linked or otherwise not linked to the program. But it's absolutely clear that there has been a pattern which was warned about as far ago as February the 18th last year, and it beggars belief that the Auditor-General's inquiry has ruled out discussion of the causes and consequences of the program in contributing to these tragedies.
And the Federal Opposition Leader, Tony Abbott, says the government must compensate insulation companies.
There's also all the businesses that invested large amounts of money on the strength of what they thought was a commit from the government, and the government owes something to them as well, and they've got to be appropriately looked after.
The Opposition Leader, Tony Abbott, ending that report from Sabra Lane. Australia has been singled out as having some of the best economic prospects in the developed world. The strong endorsement comes from the International Monetary Fund, which has also declared that the global recession is over. The IMF has released its twice-yearly report on the world economy, just as Treasurer Wayne Swan prepares to attend meetings of the G20 and the IMF in Washington. From the US Capitol, correspondent Kim Landers reports.
After enduring what became known as the Great Recession, the world's economy is undergoing a rapid but patchy recovery. Olivier Blanchard is the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund in Washington.
Global recovery has evolved better than we expected.
The IMF has released its World Economic Outlook, its twice-yearly report about the global economy. It says the recovery in major advanced economies will be, quote, relatively sluggish, and that the US is off to a better start than Europe and Japan. However, it's Australia that's singled out for praise. The IMF says, quote, Australia and the newly industrialised Asian economies are off to a strong start and will likely stay in the lead, end quote. The IMF says Australia's economic growth is expected to be 3% this year and 3.5% next year. The IMF says growth in Australia will be helped by strong demand for commodities, particularly from China. And it says unemployment in Australia will average 5.3% this year and 5.1% next year. Carmen Reinhart, who's a professor of economics at the University of Maryland, says there's a reason why Australia is standing out.
I would single out the relatively low levels of indebtedness, both public and private, that Australia currently has.
The IMF says there's an urgent need for advanced economies to address debt levels. And it's also raised concerns that some governments are running out of options to stimulate their economies, having already reduced interest rates to record lows. Meanwhile, the IMF is predicting the global economy will grow by 4.25%. China is leading the pack with expected growth of 10%, India 8.8%, and the US can expect economic growth of 3.1%. This is Kim Landers in Washington for AM.
The US Defense Secretary wants an overhaul of America's complex licensing system for weapons systems and defense hardware. Robert Gates calls the current setup a Byzantine amalgam of bureaucracies, which is hurting US alliance partners like Australia. And he's called for the US Senate to ratify a stalled defense cooperation deal with Canberra. From Washington, Craig McMurtry reports.
America is the world's number one arms dealer, selling billions of dollars of military hardware each year. To ensure sensitive weaponry and technology doesn't fall into enemy hands, countries and defense companies have to navigate a complex export licensing system involving three US government departments. Robert Gates says it might be stringent, but it isn't working.
The United States is thought to have one of the most stringent export regimes in the world, but stringent is not the same as effective.
Speaking to a room of defence business executives, Secretary Gates says if allies like Australia and Britain have bought an entire combat vehicle or aircraft, they shouldn't have to chase licences for individual components.
Not too long ago, a British C-17 spent hours disabled on the ground in Australia, not because the needed part wasn't available, but because US law required the Australians to seek US permission before doing the repair. These are two of our very strongest allies, for God's sake.
And the Defense Secretary called for the US Senate to get on with ratifying stalled treaties on defense cooperation with Australia and Britain. Signed back in 2007, they cut through much of the bureaucracy for select, trusted defense contractors.
These agreements would substantially improve our ability to equip and support US, UK, and Australian forces deploying in combat operations.
US senators have demanded more information, and Matt Schroeder from US Arms Monitor, the Federation of American Scientists, isn't happy about the deals. He says the current licensing system has largely worked, with sensitive US weapons kept off the black market.
Even if you have an airtight process with these two, and I don't know if that's the case, it sets a precedent that presumably other countries will demand. We have other close allies, and they're going to want the same benefits as UK and Australia.
While a broader overhaul of the defence export licensing system still has a long way to go on Capitol Hill, Matt Schroeder says senators have come under intense lobbying, and he expects that the special deals for Britain and Australia will be ratified. This is Craig McMurtry for AM.
And you are listening to AM, where it's approaching 8:15. For the first time, Pope Benedict has spoken publicly on the predator-priest sex abuse scandal embroiling the Catholic Church. The Pope says he shares the victim's suffering and will implement effective measures to protect children. Leaders in the Australian Catholic Church say his acknowledgement is overdue, but say it's better late than never. Bronwyn Herbert reports.
Each week in St Peter's Square, Pope Benedict speaks to thousands of pilgrims and visitors to the Vatican. But his latest address was the Pontiff's first public uttering, acknowledging the Church's involvement in child sexual abuse.
I wanted to meet some people who were victims of abuse by members of the clergy. I shared with them their suffering, and with emotion I prayed with them, promising them action on the part of the Church.
Over the weekend, Pope Benedict met with eight men in Malta who say they were molested by priests at a local orphanage. Victim groups have been calling on the Pope to acknowledge the issue directly instead of using vague references. Australian Catholic bishops acknowledge the Pope's public address is overdue.
There's been criticism from a number of quarters, including from very senior Church personnel, that the Vatican, particularly at the bureaucratic level, hasn't been as responsive to this question internationally as it ought to be. But I think it's now very timely and important that the Pope make the explicit statements that he's made.
Father Brian Lucas is the General Secretary of the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference. Do you think it's all come a little bit too late for the Church?
Better that the issue be confronted and dealt with. Yes, in hindsight, it would have perhaps been helpful for comments like this to have been made at a much earlier point in time.
The sexual abuse crisis has exploded in recent months, and the Pope, in his public address, promised direct action. But Father Lucas says in Australia, despite ongoing scandals still being heard in the courts, he's confident child protection policies are adequate.
I think Australia has been very much ahead of this issue. From the late 1980s, the Australian bishops had in place protocols to deal with these matters. That's well known and publicised in our document Towards Healing that's very available publicly on the Bishops' Conference website. The Australian child protection regime would be a model many other countries could usefully follow.
But despite Father Lucas's assertions, a spokesman for the Archbishop of Melbourne has confirmed the Church is in discussions with police to change the way it investigates sex abuse claims. A spokesman for the Archbishop told AM that only one priest has been defrocked since 1996, despite almost 300 sexual abuse claims being substantiated. The victim support group, Broken Rights, says the Church has for too long regarded sex abuse as a sin and not a crime.
Bronwyn Herbert reporting. Victoria Police has set up a special task force to investigate the web of circumstances that may have led to Carl Williams's murder. The convicted killer was bashed to death in Victoria's highest security jail on Monday. Victoria Police Command is stressing that Task Force Driver, as it's known, won't just be focusing on the possibility of police corruption. Samantha Donovan reports.
After Carl Williams was killed on Monday, Victoria Police Deputy Commissioner Sir Ken Jones reluctantly acknowledged there may be ramifications for existing investigations and court cases. The setting up of Task Force Driver seems to confirm that he was right. Sir Ken Jones.
I think that given Carl Williams' significance in organised criminality, it would be, I would think, a very brave chief that would say that this begins and ends with the incident when Carl Williams was murdered. I've told Doug Farr and his team to leave no stone unturned, to follow the evidence and the intelligence wherever that takes him.
Sir Ken says Task Force Driver will look at issues beyond the homicide investigation.
We're aware and we understand the public concerns surrounding this, so whilst it's not specifically targeted at corruption. Clearly, if corruption is discovered, we will deal with it. Frankly, there are a number of identities around Carl Williams and his cohort from some time back that we will actually be investigating as well. It's not just about relationships between Victoria Police staff and Carl Williams. It's much broader than that.
Sir Ken says Task Force Driver may investigate any allegations of possible involvement of prison staff in Williams' death.
That depends on where the evidence and where the intelligence takes us in the next weeks and months. And we may initiate covert or even overt activity around that. Bernie Edwards' team are working with corrections and they are looking at how the circumstances came about surrounding Carl Williams' death. And clearly they're talking to corrections staff.
Task Force Driver will have a similar setup to the Piranha Task Force, which investigated the gangland war. And Sir Ken says it'll draw heavily on Piranha's expertise and intelligence. It'll be made up of detectives from the crime department and other parts of the force. Sir Ken Jones was appointed a Deputy Commissioner of Victoria Police last year after a long career in Britain. He was asked how difficult it was to find detectives with no links to the gangland saga for Task Force Driver.
Try to deliver a degree of independence, but very difficult in an organisation to find people who don't know people who knew people. The degree of independence I think I'd like you to sort of take notice of is my involvement in this. Obviously, I don't come to this with any baggage.
Detective Superintendent Doug Fryer will lead Task Force Driver.
I suppose just like to stress too, it's not an anti-corruption task force, but we will look at whatever comes our way.
Victoria's Police Corruption Watchdog, the Office of Police Integrity, will oversee the work of Task Force Driver as well as the Williams homicide investigation.
Samantha Donovan. Critics say the Brumby government is in a state of denial with its flat rejection of calls for a royal commission to look into the wider circumstances of Carl Williams' death. Victoria Police has acknowledged Williams' murder will have serious ramifications for the criminal justice system. Liberty Victoria says it was surprised by the Premier, John Brumby's response when he said a royal commission was unnecessary and inappropriate. Here's Alison Caldwell.
Victoria's Premier, John Brumby, had had 3 days to consider his response to mounting calls for a royal commission into possible police corruption in the wake of the death of gangland killer Carl Williams. This is how he handled it.
What occurred in the prison was obviously unacceptable, but the person concerned was a serial killer. I think it would be quite unnecessary and quite inappropriate use of taxpayers' money to have a royal commission. The three inquiries are there. I think they're more than enough to do the job.
To me, it was almost that he's accepting that we go back to some sort of head-on stake medieval time.
Former detective and police whistleblower Simon Illingworth was staggered to hear the Premier's comments. He's one of many who support the establishment of a royal commission in Victoria.
I mean, this sort of situation's not good enough. It's not about Carl Williams. It's about the judicial system, it's about the jail system, it's about policing. And so this is touching on numerous things that are very, very dear to a democracy.
Police Corruption Watchdog, the Office of Police Integrity, is overseeing the police investigation into the death of Carl Williams. At the same time, the OPI is under review itself. The Proust Review is due to report shortly. Critics say the Premier is in denial and thinking more about his re-election chances than what's best for Victoria. Liberty Victoria was surprised with the Premier's response. Spokesman Jamie Gardner.
Clearly, every death, every killing, every murder is a serious matter, and the proper investigation of a murder does not depend upon the character of the deceased. That would be that must have been an inadvertent, careless and very foolish remark. The murder, which may well have tentacles reaching into other parts of government and the police, is very bad, has a wider influence.
Liberty Victoria's Jamie Gardner ending Alison Caldwell's report. A serious rift has developed in one of Australia's richest and most powerful environment groups, the Wilderness Society. Later today, Tasmania's Supreme Court will hear a complaint designed to have the group's last annual general meeting ruled invalid. The Society's state-based campaign centres want members to dump the group's national leadership team. As Ashley Hall reports, the national management team has a plan of its own.
Forged in the fires of the battle to stop the construction of a dam in Tasmania's Franklin River in 1976, the Wilderness Society has grown to become one of the nation's richest and most powerful environment groups. Its membership now numbers 45,000. But in the eyes of at least some members, the group has lost direction along the way.
The executive director and his self-appointed management committee have led the organisation into a really desperate stage.
Felicity Wade is the Wilderness Society's campaign manager for New South Wales. She's one of six campaign managers who've written to members urging them to dump the group's national leadership.
There's been a culture of bullying operating really for a number of years now, with financial mismanagement, with over $1 million of member money being spent on consultancies just last year. I guess most importantly, there's been identified a real failure of campaign leadership.
Felicity Wade says the group's national leaders thwarted attempts to raise these issues by holding last year's annual general meeting in secret.
14 people turned up, 6 of them the committee themselves, who re-elected themselves, and off they went. So it's been impossible for the members and the staff to call these people to account.
The validity of that meeting will be tested in Tasmania's Supreme Court today. But regardless of the outcome, the campaign managers are calling on Wilderness Society members to travel to Canberra to voice their concern at a special general meeting on the 2nd of May. The meeting's been called by the Society's Executive Director, Alec Maher, who wants to change the constitution to allow postal votes for the election of the leadership group.
It's true that we have used consultants on a number of things, but you need to, on occasion, when you're developing new business models. What we see here is a series of accusations, not all of which are baseless, and they're just a pretext for a small group of people to take control.
So there's been no bullying?
None that I'm aware of, and we don't have a single formal complaint of bullying in the organisation. We have never had in the history of the organisation a formal complaint against bullying. What I will say is that these are a series of accusations designed to blur the lines so that a small group of people can make sure that our 45,000 members never get the opportunity to be involved in setting the direction of the organisation through a postal ballot. That, I think, is a real disgrace.
Alec Maher, the Executive Director of the Wilderness Society, ending Ashley Hall's report. And you can hear an extended interview with him and with Felicity Wade on our website after the program. An independent review of the government's emissions trading scheme has described its plans for free carbon permits to heavy emitters as a $20 billion waste of money. The Melbourne-based Grattan Institute conducted an industry-by-industry audit and has concluded that steel and cement should be the only industries to be assisted with free permits. The study also found that oil refiners and aluminium producers were likely to leave Australia regardless of any compensation from the emissions trading scheme. The report's co-author, Professor John Daly, is speaking with our business editor, Peter Ryan.
In many cases, these industries are very profitable. They have natural competitive advantages because they are in Australia. And there's no doubt that providing them with free permits will mean that their profits are higher than they would be with no free permits. But equally, there's every indication that those industries will in fact continue to operate in Australia, even if they're paying a carbon price, and even if they're not receiving free permits.
So what industries are you referring to when you say that the $20 billion in free permits would be misdirected?
Well, particularly when you look at the LNG industry, the alumina industry and the coal industry, we found that by and large, those industries are not likely to relocate offshore as a result of a carbon price.
What industries do you think should get the free permits or that type of compensation?
Well, we looked at both steel and cement, and both of those have industry economics that means with a full carbon price, they will struggle to compete against imports and their exports in the case of steel may struggle to compete. However, we think that there will be a better regime than free permits. We think we will be better to have a border tax adjustment so that if you want to import cement into Australia, you effectively pay a carbon levy on it as you bring it in, equivalent to the carbon levy, whether it's collected as a tax or whether it's collected through permits. That's what you would pay as you import cement. We believe that there are ways of imposing those kind of regimes that are consistent with WTO rules, so World Trading Organization rules. And it would also have the advantage that it doesn't distort the market, because if you impose a full carbon price on cement without any free permits, then people will look at, well, maybe there's a different way of constructing this at the margin. Maybe I can build it out of wood or build it out of plastic or whatever. And the whole point of a carbon price is that you encourage people to make those trade-offs. And using a free permitting regime means that those trade-offs don't get made as efficiently as they could.
So do you believe it's more important for those heavy carbon-emitting industries to get with the program now rather than putting off the inevitable?
Well, that's certainly the thrust of our report. And I guess the way that we look at it is that we think that carbon constraints are going to happen, whether they happen this year or next year or in 2 years' time, who knows. But it's clearly the way that the world is moving over the longer term. I guess what we're hoping that this study will do is provide people with reassurance that, in fact, it's not that bad. In fact, there's not going to be widespread job losses or plants moving offshore. And actually, the worst thing that we could do is to implement a carbon pricing scheme that played off those fears to provide a large quantity of industry assistance that is not necessary, that's going to cost the rest of the Australian taxpayers a lot of money, and which, worst of all, is probably going to slow adjustment of the economy towards lower carbon emissions.
The report's co-author and chief executive of the Grattan Institute, Professor John Daly, speaking to our business editor, Peter Ryan, and the full interview with Professor Daly will be on the AM website a little later this morning. To the financial markets now, and in New York, the Dow Jones has closed at 11,125 points. That's up 8 points. The Nasdaq closed up 4 points. The FTSE in London down 60. The dollar fetching 92.7 US cents and 69.2 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley. It's 8:30.